From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as doctors try to stop the spread of Ebola in Zaire, we look back at how an earlier outbreak was contained. Donald Francis was part of the team that stopped the spread of Ebola in Sudan in 1976. Since 1981, he's worked on the AIDS epidemic. He's the former director of the CDC's AIDS laboratory, and he's now working at a pharmaceutical company on the development of an AIDS vaccine. We'll talk with him about his work with Ebola and AIDS. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews How Natives Think, a new book by anthropologist Marshall Solons about the death of Captain Cook. Solon's theories about Cook have stirred up a debate which gets to the heart of identity politics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Ebola virus continues to slowly spread in Zaire as doctors try to contain the epidemic. The virus was first identified in 1976 during outbreaks in Zaire and Sudan. My guest, Donald Francis, was part of the World Health Organization team that controlled the 1976 Ebola epidemic in Sudan. Earlier, he'd helped eradicate smallpox from Sudan, India, and Bangladesh. Since 1981, Francis has worked on the AIDS epidemic. He was one of the first scientists to suggest that AIDS was caused by a virus. In the film adaptation of Randy Schultz's book, And the Band Played On, about the early days of the AIDS epidemic, Francis was portrayed by Matthew Modine. And speaking of movies, Francis was a consultant for the film Outbreak. Donald Francis is the former director of the Center for Disease Control's AIDS laboratory activities. He's now working in the private sector on the development of an AIDS vaccine. I asked him if he's confident that the current Ebola outbreak will be stopped.
If the reaction of both the public health community and the community at large is appropriate, yes. I think that this disease, in contrast to HIV, which has a long incubation period during which people are infectious and therefore can sneak out into all sorts of avenues silently, Ebola comes down very quickly, and so you can see your cases very rapidly, and that actually makes it tougher on the individuals who are infected because they die very rapidly, but from a public health standpoint, makes it easier to control. I'm concerned when I look back at the way we deal with public health, I'm just concerned that we underfund and underrespond to these epidemics in terms of the public health response. The people, interestingly, are very concerned from the press information, individuals I talk to. Everyone's concerned about Ebola, interestingly. But actually, when you're out there in the field, it's remarkable how poorly outfitted you are with just a few people. And as a matter of fact, when we were in the 76 epidemic, we had a Land Rover and two vehicles and essentially no communication with the outside world. It wasn't for about a week and a half before we even got an airplane where we could move stuff in and out and ultimately radio contact with the outside world. I know that sounds strange for the press, where you guys have instant satellite communication, and I wouldn't be surprised if the doctors out there in the field right now were still begging some radio, UN radio station that went as long as there was no lightning and someone had some electricity.
Let's talk a little bit about your experiences in Sudan in 1976. You headed the World Health Organization team that was investigating Ebola in Sudan. How did you get the assignment, and why did you accept it?
I was actually a member of the team. David Simpson from the London School of Tropical Medicine was the head of the team. Actually, it was two of us for most of the time, which consisted of the whole team. I had come back from smallpox eradication with WHO on what CDC calls career development. I was sent to Harvard to do my infectious disease training and a doctorate in virology. And I just got a call at home saying there was this outbreak of this dangerous disease in Sudan of unknown cause. Realized we didn't know what the virus was at that time. They knew that I was formerly head of the smallpox program in Sudan. I was familiar with the country, spoke some Arabic, and was just asked if I were interested in going over in the outbreak. And I said, well, it's it's difficult because I've got classes at Harvard and would make it difficult. But if everyone, if all my professors agreed, I would be willing to do it. And I said, well, what is this? And they said, well, it's a Marburg-like agent. Marburg was the only virus of this group that we knew at the time. And I kind of went, my God, because knowing that this was a very deadly agent. But it's interesting. You ask why. It didn't take me more than about 2 seconds to say yes.
I guess that's where the action was, no matter how dangerous, huh?
Yeah, we just... I think the world in the United States is fortunate to have a Centers for Disease Control where that's what we do. Before I even unpacked my bags on my car, then the first assignment with CDC, I had a plague case and was out driving this car full of all my baggage out to investigate a plague case. From there, it went to cholera and smallpox and many other diseases. So that's what we do. We're good at it. We know how to survive. And so you just do it.
Did you have any trouble getting into the places in which Ebola had already broken out in Sudan?
Yeah, it was very difficult for really two reasons. One was pure logistical. This was way out on the Zaire, CAR border, way in the southwestern corner of Sudan. There's only, at that time, I think 200 miles of paved road in the largest country in Africa, so you can imagine what it'd be like just getting there. And second, the area was quarantined out, that the... The world had already said, okay, let's put a barrier around these folks and keep them in, which also meant that we couldn't get in. And then when we wanted to actually had someone sponsor an airplane for us, they said that we had to charter that from Nairobi. And the folks said, well, if you chartered it, if it landed on the airport in Sudan, they would burn it when it came back to Nairobi. So it took a few weeks to negotiate all these things.
But you got in.
So we flew down ultimately to Juba, and then you drive about... Oh, I think it was about 12, 13 hours directly west.
What shape was the hospital in when you got there?
The hospital itself had already been evacuated completely. Everyone had run to the bush. And the local authorities had made two hospitals, basically mud-thatched hospitals with palm frond roofs, with a fence around it, with all the... instead of barbed wire, it was thistled bushes to keep everyone out, and a watch guard for that gate. And the there were patients inside with basically one nurse, a woman's ward and a men's ward, and one nurse to take care of them.
How did you dress yourself to go into the hospital, which was the site of the most infections? I mean, you knew that there were going to be viruses around there.
Now, you look a little bit like a spaceman. The poor patients that saw us coming must have been shocked. You have a full isolation gear on the outside, which basically was like surgical gowns and gloves and booties and hats. And then we didn't have the battery-powered respirator, just a regular big gas mask-like respirator that fit over your head completely.
What was your reaction to the first patients with Ebola that you saw?
Well, actually, very similar to my first reaction to AIDS patients, except that the clock has spun faster. The Ebola patients were incredibly sick and had that same wasted look that an AIDS patient has, where just in a matter of days they seem to lose half their body mass. Extremely toxic, extremely sick, lying in bed, basically almost semi-comatose, and then oozing blood from any orifice that is there, and certainly any one that we put in medically when you take blood from them, the hole that the needle caused would continue to ooze blood. They were extremely sick individuals.
So it must be very easy for a doctor in a hospital that is not well-equipped to catch the virus because the patient is always oozing some kind of body fluid.
That's the issue is really the exit of the virus. If the virus is primarily in the blood, there is blood oozing out everywhere and really, frankly, bloody diarrhea and vomit. So there's lots of virus around these patients. In contrast to an AIDS patient where there's quite a bit of virus in the blood, but the blood's not getting out of the body. Ebola oozes out, and so anyone in close contact picks it up, presumably picks it up on their hands and then probably scratches their nose or gets it onto a mucous membrane, and then they get infected from there.
Was your mission to find the source of the virus or to help the medical staff deal with the virus?
our mission was really three-pronged. One was to control the epidemic, number one, in a public health sense. Two, to take care of patients, or at least provide the material to take care of patients. We didn't directly deal with them in terms of hospital care, other than advice. And then three was to figure out the whole epidemiology and source of the epidemic.
Now, I know one of the things that you did in Sudan was order a halt to the funerals. Why did you need to do that?
The investigation of the cases, it was just like the early cases of AIDS or any other epidemic. You just make a line listing of all the cases and where their contact came from. And we found that there were really three major sources of infection. One was sexual contact early in the epidemic. And then these patients got to this teaching hospital where all these nurses were. And so secondary infection to all the hospital staff. And then third was the cases that occurred in people at home who had not necessarily nursed the individual, because they were certainly at risk, but who had joined in the funeral, which included washing of the body through the common ritual practices there, and therefore picking up the blood and on their hands, much like a nurse, but in this case, after the death of the individual.
So what did you do with the bodies of the victims of Ebola?
We actually took charge of them after they died in the hospital and buried them ourselves.
And you had protective equipment to do that with?
Yes.
Did people object to that?
Strongly.
And what'd you tell them?
That's the way it was, that it was a danger to them and that they would just have to put up with it.
What means did you have to enforce that, though? Did you have, like, public officials who were willing to enforce that rule for you?
The public officials, the ones who made the rule, the World Health Organization, in a situation like this, has no authority. It's only the local authorities, and they say this is the way it is. And I realize this whole area was quarantined, and they were basically running a police state at this point, so there was no question of the authority.
What were the most effective ways you had to control the Ebola virus in Sudan?
Oh, it's really straightforward. It's just putting a barrier between the infected individuals and their close contacts. That barrier can be just information for people. They just stay away from people who are sick. Indeed, ultimately stay away from the hospitals and just don't, either as a patient or as a worker. And then those that must have contact with individuals put the barrier in terms of a latex barrier between the individual and the patient, the healthcare worker and the patient.
But what would somebody do if they were with a member of the family at their home and that person was sick and they had diarrhea or they were throwing up or something and someone in the family had to clean it up and maybe they didn't have latex gloves around? What options would they have?
They would likely die.
The family member who was cleaning up?
Yes. So what we did was set up fever surveillance for new cases, and then as soon as they had new cases, we would bring them into the hospital.
My guest is Donald Francis. He was part of the World Health Organization team that controlled the 1976 Ebola outbreak in Sudan. He's directed the CDC AIDS laboratory and is now working on the development of an AIDS vaccine. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with epidemiologist Donald Francis. Now, when you got to Sudan, you didn't know what Ebola was, right? I mean, had it not been identified yet?
Correct.
What was the point of identification? I don't mean what was the purpose, but what was the moment of identification?
Well, the first identification was really the identification of the epidemiology, which occurred long before the virus. Realize we don't really necessarily care more than academically what the name of the virus is or what it looks like. But it's a matter of how it's transmitted, and that'll set up your design of your control strategies, not to mention how you preserve your life yourself, because you really can't walk around in a tropical rainforest with your respirator on all day. You'll probably die of heat exhaustion. And it was really nice to be able to know that I could take that off out there interviewing patients and in huts and such. And within a couple of days of interviewing surviving family members or patients, you really can figure out that it was really the people with the closest contact. Indeed, if you slept in one of these little huts that were a couple of meters across with the patient, as long as you didn't contact the patient, they didn't get ill, so that you could define that it was not airborne, which is absolutely critical finding that if it's not airborne, then it's much easier to control. And that was all done within the first week after our arrival. All those data started coming in with our investigation. Then we actually would take specimens from patients, either living patients taking blood or dead patients doing autopsies, and shipping that off into high-security laboratories, either at CDC in Atlanta — there are very few of these in the world — or Porton Down in England. That's where the virus was actually identified.
Did you try to look for the carrier of Ebola?
Yes. The fascinating thing about the 76 Sudan outbreak, and indeed another one 3 years later in 79, was they both originated in one cotton factory in a place called Enzara in Sudan. Other than the cases in the cotton factory, you could always find that a nurse would be taking care of one patient, and that nurse would go home, and someone would take care of the nurse at home, and they would all come down. You could make a clear chain of transmission from person to person to person. In contrast, the first cases in the epidemic started almost simultaneously and had no direct personal contact. They just all worked in this one cotton factory. We did a great deal of effort to trapping animals, taking their organs and blood from them and sending back to the laboratory to try to find the source that was presumably around that cotton factory. And that occurred in 76, and again in 79. There was a great deal of effort spent to try to figure it out. And never did we get a virus out of any of those specimens.
So you tried to trap the animals that lived around the cotton factory?
Correct. We caught bats and rats and mice, uh-huh. and then you bring them back and realize you're doing this all out in the bush with considerable danger. You've got to now kill these animals and then dissect them and take out their organs and blood, all with the fear that if you stuck yourself with a needle, you'd get infected yourself.
Now, have scientists come any closer since 1976 in figuring out what animal or insect carries the Ebola virus?
Nope.
What explains that? Why is it? Why is this particular virus that hard to track?
It's just typical, actually, of our learning curves. There's not multiple outbreaks. I remember when I first joined CDC, we always had these case of bacterial infection called salmonella, and people always wondered where the salmonella would come. And we had these little kids, young kids with no known exposure, and then everyone just started walking around their house and found all these play turtles. Remember those turtles that people used to paint the shells and sell them at the circuses and such? And they happened to be farmed in the south of the United States in these big puddles, and they would get contaminated with salmonella and bring it home to the kids. Just somebody has to be in the right place at the right time to make the observation, and then it all falls in place. The problem is you're often dealing, by the time the epidemic starts with this first case that gets introduced in the hospital, and then everything goes on, you have all this chaos. You're working for weeks and months to put out the fire. Trying to find the smoking source is sometimes very difficult, but hopefully in this one, I'm sure there'll be a major investigation to try to find it. The difficulty here is the logistics in Zaire are extremely difficult right now, and the political situation very difficult and sometimes not conducive to do that kind of research. But let's hope we find it this time.
How long did that first epidemic in Sudan last?
Oh, gosh, I've forgotten. Must have been a couple of months.
What are your thoughts about how it stopped? Do you think it stopped because of the effective measures that you and other scientists took?
And the people, yes. Separating yourself from the infection is what stops it.
What were your worst fears at the time about it spreading? Were you confident that you'd be able to contain it?
This was a quite rural area, and we had, I think the population total town was probably 20,000 people. And so we got control of the entire situation, felt confident that you could deal with it. That would be more difficult. And cases indeed from there, always in these epidemics, the most prominent person who gets sick, in this case the doctor or the head of the teacher at the school, find their way to the next regional hospital and then ultimately to the capital city. And that's the greatest concern, is that it'll get into a hospital where people don't suspect it anywhere in the world. You'd be surprised at the ability of individuals from the most distant part of the world to travel all around the world. We had an individual who was in direct contact with a case out there who was in London 2 days later. Luckily didn't bring the infection with her, but certainly could have. And in this case, there were nurses, or there were nuns from the headquarters of the Italian nuns in Zaire, who actually went down to the funerals of these nuns who died of Ebola and then went back to Italy. So the world is extremely small, and that's why we have such concern for these epidemics.
Did anyone on your medical team get infected?
None of us on our medical team got infected. We did, unfortunately, have a laboratory worker in England who was dealing with our specimens who stuck himself through his glove and was infected. Fortunately, he survived.
Did you have to perform autopsies on patients?
Yes.
Take the same precautions for autopsies as you do when you're treating somebody? Is it any different?
No, it's exactly the same. The difficulty in this case for me personally was that we didn't have an autopsy facility and literally had to do this out in the ground behind the hospital and without the proper storage of your sharp instruments, and in retrospect, was probably far more dangerous than of a risk, far greater of a risk than I should have taken, because if you stuck yourself with those instruments, just like the immunization clinic patients, you probably had about a 90 to 100% chance of literally dying.
What are the similarities and differences between the Ebola outbreak in Sudan in 1976 that you helped control and the outbreak now in Zaire?
The only major difference, it seems, is that this the first hospital to really amplify the outbreak was in a large metropolitan area of a few hundred thousand people. That puts potentially a lot more people at risk. Realize all those patients who were in the hospital next to those cases are at risk if blood was shared, which it can be on people's hands from one patient to the next. And then they all go home, and then they get sick and come to another hospital. And so the fact of having a larger urban area is certainly of concern. Transport is even better at this day and age than it was then, and so people can get around more. And the more you can get around, the smaller the world becomes, and the more likely that you spread it elsewhere. But on the other side, that we have better communication now. Luckily, somebody recognizes relatively early, and luckily we have a Centers for Disease Control and a World Health Organization to respond to these situations. They called, and once you get the alert out and people start hearing about it, that the great media coverage of this is a tremendous public health benefit, and people learn to stay away from people with fever, and then that barrier between the infected and uninfected people widens, and hopefully the outbreak will recede. But it is different in that it is in a more urban area.
Do you think there's much of a chance that Ebola will spread to the United States?
No, I think as long as there's teams out there controlling it and there's very good surveillance around the world for people with fever and getting them isolated before large numbers of people come in contact with it, I think the likelihood of it getting into the United States is low.
Donald Francis is an epidemiologist who helped control the first Ebola outbreak in 1976. He's now working on the development of an AIDS vaccine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Donald Francis will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, comparing the Ebola virus and HIV. We continue our conversation with epidemiologist Donald Francis about identifying and containing the two viruses. Francis helped contain an Ebola outbreak in 1976 in the Sudan. He's worked on the AIDS epidemic since 1981. He was one of the first scientists to suggest AIDS was caused by a virus. Now Francis is working on an AIDS vaccine. Also, can someone who belongs to one group ever speak for another group? That question is at the heart of identity politics, and it's at the center of a debate surrounding the new book, How Natives Think, by anthropologist Marshall Sollins. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with epidemiologist Donald Francis. He helped eradicate an old virus, smallpox, and has worked to control two emerging viruses, Ebola and AIDS. He was part of the World Health Organization team that controlled the first outbreak of Ebola in 1976, when it struck Sudan and Zaire. He's worked on the AIDS epidemic since 1981. He directed the Center for Disease Control's AIDS Laboratory and is now working at a biotechnology company on the development of an AIDS vaccine. Francis was one of the first scientists to suggest that AIDS was caused by a virus. Since you had worked on viruses that probably originated in the rainforest, did you suspect that AIDS could be a rainforest virus?
Relatively early on in the AIDS epidemic, we were notified again by our contacts around the world that there were cases of AIDS in Central Africa. And very early on, CDC sent a team to Zaire, interestingly, into Kinshasa, and found a remarkably high number of AIDS cases in the hospital in Kinshasa.
HIV and Ebola now come under that category of emerging viruses. What are the connections, if any, between those two viruses?
I don't think there's any drastic connection of those viruses versus any others. You could take Hanta in the southwestern United States or Lyme disease in the east. There are new agents that come forward, like Ebola and HIV, depending on the incursion of the human population into a setting where the virus exists. And then usually a new ecological niche, in this case the modern hospital, or at least an attempt for a modern hospital where lots of patients are together and poor sanitation practices then occur, or the gay bathhouse, or the shooting gallery, or lots of mice in the southwestern hogans, etc. It's usually a similarity of all of these infections that come from ultimately an animal host of the contact with the animal to the human, and then the human contacts that would spread it from person to person. And they all fit a different and unique but very similar pattern when you put them all together. And there are many other diseases that also follow that pattern.
How did your experience with smallpox and with Ebola affect how you wanted to try to control AIDS early on in the epidemic?
Well, the mixture of the two, of smallpox and Ebola, with Ebola, it was actually behavior change. It was modifications of individuals' behavior in caring for patients or sexual contact or healthcare workers that you needed to institute a behavioral change program to actually stop transmission. And that's exactly the way we worked with HIV, not having a vaccine. With smallpox, we had a vaccine, and so the logic was very clear. If you found the cases and surrounded them, the barrier you put around smallpox cases, being an airborne spread disease, was a vaccine barrier. In both of these, you can successfully control the epidemic. Obviously, the behavior change is far less perfect than a vaccine, and for HIV, we sure need a vaccine to stop it.
Since 1986, I think it was, you've been working on a vaccine?
Did some early work, but now I'm full-time in the private sector working on HIV vaccine development. That's been for the last, 2.5 years, I guess.
How did you move in the direction from controlling outbreaks through behavior to trying to develop a vaccine?
Well, actually, I came from the vaccine era into the behavioral era.
Coming from smallpox.
Smallpox, and then actually hepatitis B. I was did some of the early work on hepatitis B vaccine, actually working with the gay community and testing the efficacy of a newly developed hepatitis B vaccine in gay men to see if it worked, and then ultimately applying that vaccine to gay men. Then the AIDS epidemic actually came right at that time. It was clear that with these diseases that the strongest tool you can have for viral infections is a vaccine, recognizing that it's extremely difficult to treat viruses. They're so small, we have very few targets to treat them, as witnessed really by the common cold. If we had good antivirals, we'd get rid of it because we all hate it. But by and large, once you get a viral infection, there's not too much you can do about it. So vaccines are absolutely critical. So the even though there's been major changes in the behaviors of individuals and HIV has been slowed around the world, it is still consuming 5 to 10,000 new people a day worldwide, and 40,000 plus new infections a year in the United States. It's still a huge epidemic despite behavioral change programs.
After years with the Center for Disease Control and the World Health Organization, why did you move into the private sector?
Well, it's where the action is in terms of vaccines. The government does not make vaccines. The private sector does. And where I'm working now, Genentech was a world leader in HIV vaccine development. So if you wanted to stop the AIDS epidemic, I figured you better make a vaccine, and this is the place to do it.
Now, you've been running clinical trials on a vaccine that you've been working on. Is there anything you could tell us about the concept behind, the theory behind this particular vaccine?
Oh, it's very straightforward that with modern biochemical techniques, we can actually manufacture any piece of a virus that you want. So we don't have to go back to the original, we don't have to grow up viruses and have the Salk-type polio vaccine and all the potential risks of both growing that and potential infection of recipients. We can actually make pieces of the virus. And so what we've done at Genentech is take the outside core or the outside envelope of the virus and made that up in massive quantities and make it up into small doses of vaccine and put that into humans. Initially, you start with safety to see if it's safe. We're actually have immunized about 1,000 Americans with this vaccine now, and except for periodic redness and swelling at the injection site, seems safe. The good news is that essentially 100% of individuals produce antibody against it. The question is, does that antibody actually prevent infection? We know that in the chimpanzee, the only animal model that we have to deal with, that this vaccine will protect a chimpanzee from a large intravenous challenge. And so we're optimistic that at least for the spectrum of different subtypes of the virus vaccine represents, that it'll protect. The question is how well, and that's going to really require large efficacy trials.
It's my understanding that NIAID, the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, put a stop to decided not to proceed with a full-scale clinical test of this particular vaccine, that the director of NIAID said that there's little chance the vaccine would work, and he didn't want to waste resources on it. So what's the status of the vaccine now?
Well, that's true. The National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease of NIH have been very helpful to us in the safety and larger early phases of the trial of these evaluating the vaccines, but has been reluctant to move on to a full efficacy trial for several reasons. The reasons they gave is they're not sure about how effective it is going to be, which is absolutely the case. That's why you do an efficacy trial. Second was their feeling that the community was not ready, that the gay community especially was strongly supporting the research money be put into a cure and not in a vaccine. And last, the director of NIAID said the epidemic in the United States is not
justify moving ahead with these trials. I think it's an unfortunate decision, and so we're moving off to other places that are more interested in evaluating and value vaccines greater than the United States does, and most immediately that's Thailand.
So you need the government's permission to get started there?
Oh, no, the government's very interested. The issue of vaccines really is one centered around value. In my 25 years working with prevention, I really am not convinced yet that the American public, or indeed the, quote, more industrialized, advanced public, is really committed to prevention, and vaccines are just a part of that. We're much more interested in the magic bullet, and we don't deal very well with valuing prevention, and since we rely on the private sector to make vaccines, if there's not a value there, the private sector will move elsewhere where there is, and that's really into therapeutic drugs. We will spend millions and millions of dollars to try to treat people even for non-treatable conditions and yet not deal with the issues of preventing the disease in the first place. So that's relatively disconcerting working in the United States. My experience in the tropics is those people understand, since they are face-to-face with the polios, the diphtherias, the tetanuses, that they know the value of vaccines and want to encourage their development, whereas the United States seems far more reticent to do that.
My guest is epidemiologist Donald Francis. He was part of the World Health Organization team that controlled the 1976 Ebola outbreak in Sudan. He's directed the CDC AIDS laboratory and is now working on the development of an AIDS vaccine. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with epidemiologist Donald Francis. So are you feeling encouraged, discouraged now in the development of the vaccine?
I think I'm encouraged scientifically. I think if we as a population wanted to make an HIV vaccine, we could. I just don't think the message is coming loud and clear that we care.
You were working on the eradication of smallpox, and while you were working, smallpox was in fact eradicated. That must have been really something to be a part of.
Oh, it was wonderful, because with the short incubation period, you could see it right in front of you. In India, where I was, and Bangladesh, where we actually just buried this disease within about a year and a half, you'd go into village after village just with kids decimated with this disease in the ugliest way you can imagine. And a week later, you go into the village and there's no new cases at all, just from the application of a few cent vaccine. It's a wonderful experience.
So you started your career with the eradication of smallpox. You started your career with this incredible scientific victory over illness. And then since then, it's been these mysterious emerging viruses like Ebola, like AIDS, that are more mysterious and not easily controlled. Certainly AIDS is not under control yet, and Ebola, we have a new outbreak.
But we'll be victorious if we want to. If we want to put the energy and resources into it, we can do well against these bugs. We're very smart, and they don't have any brain at all. The question is, can we take that intelligence we have and join it together with logic? But what we see today in terms of the spirit of government and the meanness that we see just today in the news, there was about the Congressman Dornan wanting to kick out all the HIV-infected members of the military. I mean, this kind of meanness that comes on against the people instead of the virus. If we want as societies to take on these viruses, we can. If we want to take on each other, then the viruses will just see the opportunity and continue to spread. I mean, to think now that more than a decade into the AIDS epidemic, we're still discussing whether teenagers need access to condoms and addicted drug users need access to clean needles is just childishness. And the kind of nonsense you hear from people like Dornan and others will continue to suffer from these agents. If, on the other hand, we decide to take them on, we can do it. It depends how mature we are. And I think we're basically childish, almost warfare-like society, and we have to become more civilized and lose this barbarian instincts we have. And I hope maybe that'll be a greater victory if we can encourage that in society than just making vaccines.
As a scientist, it's your job to investigate very dangerous viruses and to be very rational while you're investigating them. Are there times when you have more irrational fears, like at night when you're dreaming?
Most of the dreaming type stuff is the frustration that you can see your success there, and you just can't reach it. And that has occurred really three times in my life. One at smallpox, when we were having a very difficult time getting the government of India to respond, and then that broke through, and we had success. Was Ebola in terms of the unknown, where you'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then the rest has been AIDS, where we're up against illogical political leaders rather than a logical scientific knowledge base and science.
Well, Donald Francis, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Donald Francis is an epidemiologist. He's now working on the development of an AIDS vaccine at the bioengineering company Genentech. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
While the Congress considers the budget, Terry, we will also be doing a story from the middle of the country on what people think of the budget the Congress is considering. We also are following the Ethics Committee, which is considering the case of the senator from Oregon, Senator Bob Packwood. Terry Nichols was in court today in the matter of the Oklahoma bombing, and after a preliminary hearing, the judge decided that he could be held while the investigation proceeded. Also, we have stories on how Lexus is selling, considering that it's about to become much more expensive, letters from listeners, and a book of luscious desserts.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new book, How Natives Think, reopens the 200-year-old murder case of Captain James Cook. The author, anthropologist Marshall Sollins, argues that our understanding of other cultures needn't be bounded by the limitations of our own. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
When Captain James Cook was put to death by irate Hawaiian natives in February 1779, his bones were distributed among the victorious island chieftains. Now, over 200 years later, a pair of distinguished scholars are vying with each other to claim their own piece of Cook. At stake in this struggle is the answer to one of the most controversial questions of our time. That is, can someone who belongs to one group ever speak for, or even to, another group? The hubbub began in the 1980s when anthropologist Marshall Sollins first suggested Cook was killed because of a cosmic case of mistaken identity. The Hawaiians, he claimed, mistook Cook for their fertility god, Lono. Journals kept by Cook's officers attest to the fact that when Cook set foot on Maui, he was hailed as Lono and wrapped in sacred red cloth. Cook's arrival and departure from Maui eerily coincided with Lono's feast period, but then Cook's luck ran out. A storm damaged his ship, and he had to return to Maui in the middle of a month consecrated to a rival god. The Hawaiians were furious that their religious calendar had been violated, and so they sacrificed Cook. Sollins' interpretation really annoyed a Sri Lankan scholar named Gananath Obesekura. In 1992, Obesekura wrote an award-winning book entitled The Apotheosis of Captain Cook, in which he accused Sollins of being the moral equivalent of Cook. In other words, a white Westerner violating the integrity of the Hawaiians with his imperialist Heart of Darkness myth. That's the one where superstitious natives routinely deified their European conquerors. As a Sri Lankan, Obesekura claimed he had a special affinity with his fellow others, the Hawaiians. In his version of the murder mystery, rational Hawaiians killed Cook, not because they thought he was a trespassing divinity, but because of his inhuman brutality. No way, says Solins in his new book, cheekily entitled How Natives Think. Originally planned as an essay, it weighs in at over 300 snitty, witty pages and includes 17 appendices. In it, Solon dismembers Obeisekora's arguments as deftly as the Hawaiian's carved-up cook. Solon's dismisses what he calls a certain pseudo-politics of anthropology that expresses its solidarity with indigenous peoples by endowing them with the highest Western bourgeois values. Solon says Obeisekora misrepresents the Hawaiians by making them into rational thinkers, and irony of ironies, by equating them with Sri Lankans, in effect saying that all natives think alike. How Natives Think represents more than just another swipe in a typical scholarly catfight. In the overwhelming specificity of his study, Solins trumps the vulgar identity politics that infects our national dialogue from faculty lounges to bus stops. As the acknowledged dean of Hawaiian studies, Solins honors the hard work it takes to understand a different culture. At the same time, he conveys the implicit hope that we can all somehow reach beyond the boxes that frame us and block us from others. To think that Hawaiians would be intelligible only to other Hawaiians, or that women or African Americans or gay people could only really understand their own kind, that way of thinking, to Solins, leads to the real heart of darkness.
Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed How Natives Think by Marshall Solins. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of The Information, a new novel by Martin Amis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Oklahoma bombing suspect Terry Nichols is going to continue to be held without bail. A federal magistrate in Oklahoma says there's probable cause to hold Nichols. The order was issued despite FBI testimony. Phone records may prove Nichols was not in Oklahoma City the day of the bombing. FBI agent Errol Myers was the only witness present at Nichols' preliminary hearing today. Nichols' attorney asked the agent about materials found in Nichols' home, including a fuel meter. Investigators suggest the meter may have been used to measure fuel oil, one of the bomb's components. Agent Myers conceded the meter was not hooked up and was not working when agents found it. Heavy rains continue to fall over eastern Missouri, causing flash flooding and are bringing river levels near the flood stage. From member station KWMU in St. Louis, Andrea Murray reports.
About 1,400 people in the St. Louis area have been evacuated from their homes as creeks and sewers continue to overflow. Runoff from the saturated ground has washed out roads and bridges, and some communities have begun sandbagging to prepare for the expected crest this weekend of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. The Missouri River is within 4 feet of the record it reached during the flood of 93, but the Army Corps of Engineers' Ken Kraschowski says it's not likely this year's flood will be that severe.
If we don't get any further heavy rainfalls, this crest should not last anywhere near the length of time that the 93 crest lasted.
The rain is predicted to end this weekend, giving area rivers and creeks a chance to dry out. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrea Murray in St. Louis.
Just 24 hours after taking office, conservative French President Jacques Chirac has formed his government. It's balanced between centrists and conservatives and includes a majority of politicians who've never been in a cabinet before. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The new government is young, includes a record 12 women and few former ministers. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs went to centrist Hervé de Charette, who's pro-European but lacks diplomatic experience. Analysts say his appointment means that Prime Minister Alain Juppé will keep control of foreign affairs. A free trader, Alain Madelin, was made Minister of Economics and Finance. Several longtime allies of President Jacques Chirac were also given top jobs, and a former journalist, Philippe Vasseur, who supported France's militant farmers during the World Trade Talks, was made Minister of Agriculture and Food. The youngest member of the cabinet is 29 years old. He has a junior post, as do most of the women. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Actress Elizabeth Montgomery has died. A family spokesman says she died at home of cancer. She was 57. Montgomery was best known for her television program, Bewitched. On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen 77 points. This is NPR. House Republicans have defeated an alternative budget plan drafted by conservative Democrats. It would balance the budget in 7 years, but does it without a tax cut. Medicare and Medicaid would be spared some of the heavy cuts that Republicans want, but the House voted 3-1 against it. Lawmakers will take up two other alternative budget plans before they look at the official Republican measure today. A final vote on that plan is expected today. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee is looking at a Republican plan to kill three foreign policy agencies and to stop diplomats from taking part in some international meetings. Secretary of State Warren Christopher told the Senate panel today that passing the plan would be a mistake. Barry Schwein reports.
The bill, championed by Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, represents his long-held desire to make cuts in the State Department bureaucracy and, according to some estimates, save $3.5 billion. Christopher's trying to head off deep cuts by eliminating hundreds of jobs. Some Democrats would cut the three agencies, Arms Control, Aid, and the U.S. Information Agency, but have many of the same people do the same work under a State Department banner. That's not likely to satisfy Helms and his allies. If they succeed, the U.S. will stop participating in the International Labor Organization and several other international groups and will boycott a conference on women in August in Beijing. In a nutshell, it's a test of Congress's approach to U.S. operations overseas. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
The government says the trade deficit fell slightly in March to at $9.1 billion, but the trade gap with Japan and Mexico got much worse. The Commerce Department says the trade deficit was down 0.4% from February. The deficit with Japan surged 30%. A large part of that was in cars and car parts, the source of the ongoing trade dispute with Japan. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House has approved the Republican plan to balance the budget in 7 years. The vote was 238-193 and was mostly along party lines. Only one Republican voted against the budget. 8 Democrats supported it. House Speaker Newt Gingrich presided over the final roll call. A cheer went up from the Republican side of the floor when the budget gained a majority. Most Democrats battled against the measure to the end. The GOP plan would change government radically. It eliminates hundreds of federal programs, cuts others, and turns more programs over to the states. It calls for nearly $1.5 trillion in savings over 7 years. Massachusetts' highest court has upheld a judge's order that prohibits an imprisoned anti-war radical from profiting from her life story. Catherine Ann Powers surrendered 2 years ago after spending 20 years on the run for her role in the murder of a Boston police officer. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports from Boston.
Catherine Power, once on the FBI's most wanted list, pleaded guilty to driving the getaway car in a 1970 bank robbery that left Boston police officer Walter Schroeder dead. Judge Robert Bank sentenced Power to 8 to 12 years in prison and also barred her from profiting from her story or face life in prison. Power appealed that special condition, but today the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court upheld the judge's order, ruling it does not violate Power's right to free speech. Peter Gelhar is an attorney for the family of Officer Schroeder.
The family is obviously pleased that Ms. Power will not benefit financially by the loss of their husband and father, Officer Schroeder. And I think finally, and perhaps most of all, the family members are relieved just to put this chapter of their lives behind them.
Catherine Power's attorney says the ruling prevents his client from raising money for the victim's family. This is Anthony Brooks in Boston.
China has denied Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, the right to select the reincarnation of Tibet's second most important Buddhist monk, the Panchen Lama. Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing.
The Dalai Lama has recognized the six-year-old son of Tibetan nomads as the reincarnation of the Panchen Lama. The boy was born 4 months after the death of the last Panchen in 1989. According to the Dalai spokesman, the boy is still in Chinese-controlled Tibet. Today, Beijing declared the reincarnation invalid and illegal and indicated it would find its own reincarnation of the Panchen. Beijing reiterated its claim to the sole authority to select the new Panchen, a claim the Dalai makes as well. Beijing denounced the Dalai's move as another one of his conspiracies to split Tibet from China. The United States has called on Beijing to negotiate with the Dalai on the new Panchen. For National Public Radio, this is Anthony Kuhn in Beijing.
Wall Street was hit by a major sell-off today. The Dow plunged nearly 82 points to close at 4,340. Declines overwhelmed advances. This is NPR. Much of the Arab world is criticizing the United States for vetoing a UN Security Council resolution demanding an end to Israel's confiscation of land in Arab East Jerusalem. NPR Suni Khalid reports.
The reaction in the Arab world to the U.S. veto in the United Nations was swift and severe, with many diplomats and journalists arguing that Washington had lost its credibility in the region as an honest broker. In Jordan, U.S. Ambassador Wesley Egan was summoned to meet with Foreign Minister Abdel Karim Kabariti to hear Amman's disappointment with the U.S. veto. In Syria, the ruling party paper, Al-Baath, said Washington's biased policy will destroy the peace process. But in France, visiting Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres called the flap over the UN veto a lot of noise about a little story. Meanwhile, preparations are continuing for a special Arab League summit to discuss the Jerusalem issue. At least 8 heads of state are expected to attend the meeting, which has reportedly been scheduled for Morocco at the end of this month. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel says he'll step down as head of the Liberal Free Democratic Party. His group has suffered 2 major defeats in state polls. He will stay on as foreign minister and says he wants to concentrate fully on that work and as German vice chancellor. Some observers speculate quitting as party chief could weaken Kinkel's position in Chancellor Kohl's center-right governing coalition. Residents of Missouri are being evacuated to higher ground because of flooding. The latest group of people to flee are from the central part of the state along the Missouri River. Nearly half the wells in Columbia, Missouri have lost power. Demand for bottled water is high. Meanwhile, storms in Kentucky have left a trail of destruction. Officials report numerous injuries and damage to dozens of homes and businesses. Thousands of customers are without power and there are downed phone lines. A possible tornado may have ripped off the roof of a high school gym in Nicholsville. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.